The episode in which it becomes crystal clear that foreign policy is the economy by other means. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, the 21st of July. Glad, as always, to have you here, everybody. The following sentence appears on the website of the New York Times today, part of the transcript of an interview with the Republican nominee for president, Donald Trump. Of course, Mr. Trump was being interviewed about his foreign policy positions, and he was asked by David Sanger, the national security correspondent for the Times, whether members of NATO, the 67-year-old North Atlantic Treaty Organization, he was asked whether those members could count on the United States to meet its treaty obligations for mutual defense. Mr. Trump said, and here's the quote, the sentence I was talking about, "If they fulfill their obligations to us, the answer is yes," end of quote. The reference there in the course of that interview having been monetary. There is a surprising amount of economics in this interview to unpack, so we've gotten David Sanger on the phone to do that with us. David, it's good to have you back on the program.
Great to be with you, Kai.
This interview seems to imply that Mr. Trump, much like he views his business enterprises, views foreign policy as something of a zero-sum game.
It's a series of transactions for him, and you know that's to be expected if you've spent your entire life as a developer, where most things are a deal, and most deals depend on the money that's transferred. And he said, you know, why would we spend the money on troops if we're running trade deficits with these kinds of countries? So, you know, the traditional thing that one would expect to hear in the foreign policy world, which is that we have our own national interests in wanting to keep peace in the world, have troops forward deployed, have the influence that comes with that, does not seem to rank with him. He basically says, you know, that's nice, but we can't lose money doing it.
There were also several passages talking about foreign policy as an instrument of economic strength, about trade alliances, about having access to markets. Again, there, Mr. Trump is, what have you done for me lately?
Well, what he is tell me how this affects my bottom line. So he said, for example, that if he couldn't renegotiate NAFTA to his satisfaction, he would get out of it in a split second. Well, that has significant repercussions with Mexico, of course, but there's a third member of NAFTA as well. It's Canada, one of our largest trading partners and certainly one of our key military allies.
He also said at one point, when talking about negotiations and, in essence, letting the other side know you're serious, he said, you got to be willing to walk.
So he's made this argument to me before in the context of the Iran negotiation. He has said in that case that he would have walked out of the negotiation several times. When we did an interview back in March on this, I asked him what he would walk out over, and he had a little bit of a hard time with that. Ultimately, he came down to the question that he would have wanted the deal to last longer, which is certainly a mainstream critique of the Iran deal, that that after 15 years, the Iranians are essentially able to go produce what they want.
Did you get a sense, David, that there is nuance in this, that he views it as views foreign policy, rather, as a return on investment kind of enterprise, or is it simply win-lose?
I think to him it is return on investment, but the return he wants to see is pretty narrowly defined as an economic return. I don't think that his view is that anybody really needs to help the United States in defending itself. And similarly, I don't think he sees a strong national interest in us deploying abroad.
Last thing, David, then I'll let you go. Paul Manafort, the chairman of Mr. Trump's campaign, said as recently as this morning, I think, that Mr. Trump was misquoted. You had the tape recorders going, right?
Well, if you want to go up on our website, on the New York Times website, we've posted the transcript of the interview. And I haven't heard that critique since we posted the transcript of the interview.
David Sanger is the national security correspondent for the New York Times. He and his colleague Maggie Haberman did a fascinating interview with Mr. Trump yesterday. It's on the website today. David, thanks very much.
Thanks, Kai. Great to talk to you.
We got David on the line from Cleveland, as you could probably hear tonight, being the big finish of the Republican National Convention. The nominee accepts, the audience applauds, cue the balloons. Our Washington Bureau Chief Andrea Seabrook has been in Cleveland this week as well, producing our new pop-up podcast, Politics Inside Out, it's called, covering the convention, the campaigns, and also politics and this economy, both inside the hall, and therefore inside the political system, and outside. Outside is where she found Drew Bascom, a man who knows exactly what he wants from the folks inside the Quicken Loans arena.
I'm ready for everybody to go home. Like, I don't care. I'm just ready for everybody to go.
What do you do? What's your job here?
I'm a line chef.
A line chef?
Yeah.
So right. You're like cooking the food for all these people.
Yeah, you know, I play fair. I cook the food, you know. It's just me personally, I feel like this ain't got nothing to do with me. Because no matter what happens, they're going to be the same BS that we see every day as us being a black man, flat out. And then no matter what race you is, the only color that matters right about now is green, flat out. So
you mean money?
Yeah, money. Got everybody talking about Donald Trump, did Donald Trump that. But as y'all can blindly see that, Donald Trump don't care about what's going on. He just care about, I don't know what he care about. Because he's half time, he sound like he don't know what the hell he talking about. You know what I'm saying? You know, I just, like I said, I just can't wait till everybody go home so I can get back to reality.
You can hear more of Mr. Bascom on that podcast I was talking about. It's called Politics Inside Out, this week in Cleveland, next week in Philadelphia with the Democrats. Subscribe wherever you choose to get your podcasts. On Wall Street today, down all the way around, and honestly, it was about time. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Amazon is getting into the student loan business. It's a partnership with Wells Fargo offering discounts on student loans to members of its Prime Student program, which is what it sounds like, a cheaper version of Amazon Prime for students. Does kind of raise a question, though. Why are they doing that? From the Education Desk at WYPR Marketplace's Amy Scott takes a look.
Members of Prime Student pay $49 a year for free two-day shipping, unlimited video streaming and photo storage, and now
a 0.5% interest rate reduction on all Wells Fargo private student loans.
John Rasmussen leads the bank's personal lending group. He says the two companies won't exchange any money in the partnership. For Wells Fargo,
we knew that our students and families were ever increasingly online.
So it's a way to find new borrowers where they hang out, and potentially more affluent ones, the kind who subscribe to Amazon Prime. Financial aid expert Mark Kantrowitz with CapEx.com says though private student lenders have rebounded since the recession,
they still have limited funds available to make loans, so they want to make those loans to the borrowers who are going to be most profitable.
For Amazon, the deal is just another way to hook people on Prime at an early age. Analyst Michael Pachter is with Wedbush Securities.
Anything they can do to make that even more attractive is going to, you know, over the lifetime of a person's membership, drive thousands, if not, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars of purchases.
And there's another reason for promotions like this.
Look at the free publicity Amazon's getting right now because they're listening to you report on this.
Guilty as charged. To absolve myself, I'll point out that for a typical 10-year, $15,000 student loan, the savings aren't huge, about $50 a year, or just enough to cover that Prime student membership. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
There was an announcement today from a bunch of big names in the corporate and finance world. Warren Buffett, Jamie Dimon of JPMorgan Chase, Mary Barra, the CEO of GM, to name just a couple. It's a set of what they're calling common sense principles around corporate governance. You want the executive summary? Here it goes. They'd like to see public companies behave more like private ones, as Ashley Miltite reports.
This influential group of fund managers and CEOs has produced a surprisingly readable list of principles. Why now? Vanguard was one of the signees. Glenn Boreham is treasurer of Vanguard Funds. He says Vanguard and the others worried investors in public companies were losing out because of too much short-term thinking.
We're concerned in instances where companies and or boards may be more focused on short-term results than long-term sustainable results.
He says effective corporate governance can refocus a company on the long term. Among the recommendations, paying less attention to quarterly earnings. Nell Minow is vice chair of Value Edge Advisors, a corporate governance consulting firm.
This is one of those situations where it's not as important what they said as who said it.
She says these principles aren't so different from practices outside groups have put forward.
But it's important that it's people on the inside, particularly these people who are among the most influential in the corporate world.
Amy Hutton agrees. She's a professor of business administration at Boston College. She says now when an activist investor goes to a shareholder meeting
and tries to change the way that companies are behaving and governing themselves, they'll use this document to start the dialogue. Look, this document tells us what the best practices are. You aren't doing this.
The goal is for managers to focus on a company's long-term future as if it was their own business. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
All right, so get a load of this out of Facebook today. The company says it's made its first flight ever of an autonomous solar-powered plane that it hopes will eventually beam internet signals down to places in developing countries that can't get online any other way. It's a story tailor-made for our senior tech correspondent, Molly Wood. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
Talk to me about this plane thing, would you? Because, I mean, right?
Yeah, it is more than a little bit sci-fi. They built the thing out of this cured carbon fiber. They say it's stronger than steel. The wingspan is as wide as a 747. Yeah. It weighs like as much as a car.
Wow.
It's shaped like this really big boomerang, and it flies in the stratosphere. It's 60,000 to 90,000 feet.
Huh.
And it just keeps getting better and better. They plan to kind of daisy chain these things together so that one plane is talking to a hub on the ground in a city. And then several other planes fan out behind it, and they're all connected. And I really want you to hear from the source how they're going to connect these things. This is Mike Schrepfer. He's Facebook's chief technology officer. He's describing how this is all going to work.
Okay.
One of the ways we're going to be doing that is via, it's called free space optics. So we're actually using a fiber connection, but instead of, you know, in a cable, this is just shooting lasers plane to plane across the sky. So we can kind of connect these up in a backbone.
Lasers, wow. Kai.
What
lasers.
What could possibly go wrong?
The idea is that, if they're connected with these lasers, they can cover more ground. And because each plane can cover 60 square miles down on the ground, a whole network of planes could really potentially beam internet to a lot of different areas. Now, let's get back to reality. They haven't even started testing the laser stuff or even the communication stuff. They've only flown the plane so far for about 96 minutes.
How serious then do we suppose Facebook is about this?
Pretty serious. You know, Schrepfer wouldn't give me any specifics on cost, but Facebook is pouring money into R&D, research and development. That amount has increased steadily for the last 3 years. It's now about 13.5% of its overall budget. And that was in one quarter alone in 2015, $1 billion. And Facebook really sees this kind of thing as a very clear extension of its mission. Here's Schrepfer again explaining that.
Huh.
We think of ourselves as a technology company that's building technology that helps people stay in touch. And that may be newsfeed on your mobile phone, and you know, it may be providing basic internet access or the technology to allow people to have internet access.
Yeah, but wait, can we talk core competencies here for a minute, right? Because giant flying carbon fiber airplanes are one thing, I suppose. Doing the algorithm on my newsfeed is entirely another, right? Let alone the kitty cat pictures and my buddies from high school.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it is reminiscent a little bit of Google's sort of moonshot Project X stuff. Absolutely. But in Facebook's case, it's really focused on internet access. The assumption for them is that the more people they can connect, get online, the more people that can potentially become Facebook users. It's actually a slightly easier one-to-one mathematical calculation than some of the stuff that Google does.
All right. Well, granting all of that, when is this going to be real? Any clue?
It could be a while. Like I said, they're still they still have the communications array stuff to test. They say, though, that short term, maybe 3 to 5 years, they'll start partnering with operators in the developing world who might want to tap into this network. The real question, I think, is whether this all ends up to the good of the people on the ground or whether this is ultimately private infrastructure.
Molly Wood on Facebook and giant flying airplanes. Believe it or not. Thanks, Molly.
My pleasure.
coming up.
We have to remember at the same time that we talk about all of these barriers and all of these difficulties that we've done a lot.
A last look at Cleveland, Mississippi. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, that whole what me worry thing only goes so far, yeah. The Dow Industrial's off 77 points today, 0.4%, 18,517. The NASDAQ down 16 points, about a third percent, 5,073. The S&P 500 declined 7 points, 0.3%, ended things at 2,165. In what looked like good news, first-time homebuyers accounted for a third of existing home sales in June. That's the highest share since summer 2012. Median home prices also rose, however, builders got caught in a teardown. KB Home reversed 0.5%. Lennar peeled off 0.2%. In what looked like bad news, the Department of Justice officially sued to block two big healthcare mergers. We told you about them yesterday. But Aetna stock rose 1.5%. Anthem added more than 2%. Cigna took home 5%. Humana expanded by 8%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. A year ago this month, we took the show to Athens, Greece, to get a sense of how people were getting by as that country's debt crisis ground on and on. Among the people we talked to were two who were the sole breadwinners for their families. Marketplace's Stephen Beard went back to Athens not too long ago to catch up with them.
A year ago, 39-year-old Effie Panoutsakopoulou was stressed out at the bank where she works. The government had slapped on capital controls. Every day, hysterical customers clamoured to get their money out. Today, with a third bailout underway, the air of crisis has abated. But for Effie, the undercurrent of anxiety remains.
We don't have a lot of work at the bank right now, to tell you the truth. We're not working.
No? Why not? No.
We don't have any customers. Nobody has any money, so I don't know how they keep on paying our wages.
Because the bank's not making any money.
Every day that I'm closing my computer, I'm thinking how much money did I make today in order to help the bank. And the last 3 months is 5 euros per day, 10 euros per day, nothing per day. So it's hard.
Some things are better. A year ago, Effie was on the brink of divorce. Her unemployed husband bitterly resented the fact that she was the family's sole breadwinner.
Are you happier now?
Yes, we are happier. And he accepts the fact that he's going to stay home with the kids. He's becoming a better dad.
He's becoming a new man.
He's becoming a new mum. He seems more relaxed about the fact that he doesn't have any work.
And that you're the breadwinner.
Yes.
36-year-old sales manager Christos Mavrou is still the main breadwinner for his family. That's his parents, his brother and his sister-in-law. Last year, when we spoke, he was moderately upbeat. So how about now?
Last year, I had hope that something will change, that everything will go better. But now, there's no hope.
He admits, almost cheerfully, that he's struggling. Tax hikes demanded by Greece's creditors have pushed up the cost of living.
Gas is more expensive. Taxi is more expensive. Our holidays are more expensive. Everything is more expensive now.
But you're not earning any more money.
No, of course not. And of course, we will pay more taxes next year.
For Greece's government to get the third bailout, it had to make progress on balancing its books. There'll be a fresh round of tax hikes over the coming year. They could swallow up as much as 80% of some people's incomes. And for Christos, an extra financial burden, an addition to the family, a baby niece. Is that another mouth for you to feed?
It's the mouth that I want to take care, and I am taking care of her. The weight of my niece's expenses, I'm having it.
And you're happy to have it?
Of course, I'm very happy. She's adorable.
These are the largely unsung heroes of this crisis, the breadwinners who really bailed out Greece. In Athens, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
As the GOP wraps up its convention in Cleveland, Ohio tonight, we're going to take one last moment to talk about our reporting from the other Cleveland that we've been covering this week, Cleveland, Mississippi, where almost 50 years ago, Bobby Kennedy started his historic poverty tour of the Mississippi Delta. Kennedy was accompanied on that tour by an aide named Peter Adelman. They were convinced to come to the Delta by a woman who'd been working down there for years. Marion Wright was her name. 40 years later, Marion Wright Adelman and Peter Adelman are two of the best-known advocates for the needy. in this country. We talked to them as part of our election year series with Frontline and PBS NewsHour. It's called How the Deck is Stacked. You're both just back from a trip down there, I understand. And here we are almost 50 years later. What do you think?
We've made a lot of progress in our country. We've done some things that we would actually have twice as many people in poverty. But the poverty in Mississippi and in too many parts of our country is as bad or worse. And what's happened is that cash assistance, welfare, is basically gone in most states in this country. And so that all we have left, where we don't have enough jobs, are people whose only income, 7 million people in our country, only have food stamps. There's a huge hole in our safety net.
Mrs. Edelman, let me talk about race in this society today. It is such a big issue, and I'd love your thoughts on how much of a factor you think economics and inequality is in the unrest that we're seeing right now.
They're inextricably intertwined. Over 80% of the black children in Mississippi cannot read or compute at grade level in fourth or eighth grade, and the dropout rates are astronomical. What is a child going to do in this globalizing economy if they can't read and compute at the most basic levels? There is progress, but the cradle-to-prison pipeline, the level of illiteracy, the level of joblessness, the level of poverty is unacceptable, and we've got to come up with new ways of making sure that that's alleviated.
Mr. Edelman, we met a kid when we were down there. He's 13 years old. His name is Maurice Fountain. We had a really nice chat with him and his mom. He is crazy bright. But he says, and he's a African-American teenage male. He said, I am getting out of Cleveland. There is nothing here for me. There's nothing for me in Mississippi. Catch is, though, that if the bright kids leave, what does that mean for the future of places like Mississippi and the Delta and Cleveland?
Well, that is the dilemma. It's, of course, true in rural areas all over the country. Kids who have that same kind of talent never get the chance to use it. In some cases, they get arrested and they really lose their entire future. So the things that we need to do relate to figuring out how more people can get a chance by getting out, and even better than that, building an economy that people can be part of in Mississippi. And that is a tall order.
You two are now approaching 80, I think. If you live, say...
Don't even mention it, okay?
if you live, say, another 20 years, are you optimistic and hopeful that change will have progressed?
I absolutely do have an optimistic view about that. We have to remember, at the same time that we talk about all of these barriers and all of these difficulties, that we've done a lot. Robert Kennedy went home that night from Cleveland, Mississippi, and he told his children they had to do something. And he did something because he started the work that led to having a national food stamps program, which we did not have on that day in Cleveland, Mississippi. And that's really a story that can inspire us to do more in a lot of different ways. And I think we can do that.
On the other hand, I think that we are teetering on the brink of either moving backwards or moving forward as a nation. There's time for a new movement that has to come. It has to address poverty and massive economic and wealth inequality. We've got to give people hope. But this is a very real, dangerous point in our country, and it's for citizens to step up. It's for all of us to step up and say, we are not going to tolerate our children and grandchildren having to fight these battles all over again.
Marion Wright Edelman and Peter Edelman wrapping up our coverage of Cleveland, Mississippi. Stories you can hear at marketplace.org. Coming up tomorrow, by the way, stories from the other Philadelphia, the one in Mississippi. This final note today, quick and to the point, because there's not much else to say. After a week or more of speculation and in the wake of a sexual harassment lawsuit and investigation, Roger Ailes is out as the CEO of Fox News. Rupert Murdoch, the guy who owns the place anyway, is going to take over. No public mention of a much-discussed multimillion-dollar payment to make Ailes go away quietly. All right, we got to go. The Dow off 77 points today. That's about 0.4%, 18,517 on the blue chips. The NASDAQ down 16 points, about a 3%, 5,073. The S&P 500 down 7 points, 0.3%. Ended things at 2165. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, George Judson, Suzanne Levy, Andrea Seabrook, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APN. Who are the winners and losers in today's global economy? How are people's lives and livelihoods affected by their access to political power? Those are some of the questions we're getting at this election season. And now in our new pop-up podcast as well, it's called Politics Inside Out from Marketplace. Get it on iTunes or, obviously, your favorite podcast app.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.